We're discussing the history of the different exiles. So where we're up to is that Nebuchadnezzar destroyed the first Beis HaMikdash and exiled the Jewish people in three stages, or conquered and then exiled in two stages. And then Nebuchadnezzar was succeeded by his son, Evil-Merodach, who was succeeded by his son, Belshazzar. And after the handwriting on the wall, Belshazzar was assassinated, killed by his own servants. And Darius I, Daryavesh, became king. And essentially, this initiates what is called the Persian period. This is the second exile. So people get a little confused. When you hear the word second exile, you think like there was a second exile. No, the Jews were in exile. And the ruling nation became Persia, which took over the Babylonian Empire. Now, Darius I ruled for a very short time. And he died, and he was succeeded by his son, Koresh, King Cyrus. Now Cyrus, Koresh in Hebrew, is a very, very important figure, because Koresh actually gave permission to the Jewish people to return to the land of Israel and to rebuild the Beis HaMikdash. In fact, Harry Truman, who was the president who recognized the State of Israel in 1948, he liked to call himself the new Cyrus, because he was a non-Jew that kind of, you know, allowed. And whenever he was honored a lot, although he had his own anti-Semitism problems, but he was honored quite a lot by Jewish organizations after 1948. And every time they would talk about how great he was, if they didn't mention Cyrus, he would pull the jacket of the MC and say, "You forgot to say I'm Cyrus," you know. And the like. Now, here you need to understand something. Cyrus, Koresh, did allow all the Jews to return to the land of Israel. But the vast majority of Jews did not take him up. They were comfortable in Babylonia or Persia or other countries. Eretz Yisrael was in a state of desolation, a state of ruin, a state of in which there were hostile nations like the Samaritans that were living there. If you were comfortable in Babylonia, just like people are comfortable in America, why should you come to Eretz Israel? And let me point out, conditions in Israel were much, much harder than they are today. I mean, you know, there was no Ben and Jerry's, there was no all sorts of things that you didn't have in those days. So very, very few Jews did come. But those few Jews that did come, only a few Jews came, like 6,000, they began to build the second temple. They actually began to build the second temple, and they dedicated the second temple. Now what's interesting is, this is not yet 70 years. Cyrus's declaration was 52 years after the Churban. You'll see how we get 70. 52 years after the Churban is King Cyrus, they're allowed to come back. Only a few Jews come back. They do dedicate the Beis HaMikdash. In fact, according to our tradition, Mordechai of all people, was one of the people who came back. Although he then went back to Persia for the reasons that you'll see in a moment. In other words, he went from Eretz Yisrael to Babylonia, from Babylonia back to Eretz Yisrael, and then as I continue, you'll see how he wound up in Persia. Okay, so he moved around a lot. Now, what happened was, they laid the foundation for the Second Temple. They dedicated it. They brought korbanos for a while. And it is recorded that there were some older people who had remembered the destruction of the First Temple 52 years earlier. And the young people who didn't know what the First Temple was like were singing and dancing. And the old people were sobbing and weeping because they saw that the divine presence was not the same. And the Pasuk says that the crying of the old people was even louder than the singing and the dancing of the young people. Because the second Beis HaMikdash did not have that same madrega. In the book of Ezra, it is recorded that there were people, non-Jews in Israel, who were jealous and envious of the Jewish people coming back. Sounds familiar. And they're building the Beis HaMikdash. So they sent a false accusation to Cyrus, accusing the Jewish people of trying to build the temple as a way of rebelling, creating their own power base to rebel. As a result, Cyrus ordered that the continuation of the building of the temple be stopped. According to Chazal, it's not in the Pasuk, the people who were the instigators to have the stopping of the Beis HaMikdash were none other than the sons of Haman, that they were involved in getting the Beis HaMikdash to be stopped. The construction of the temple was stopped for 18 years. Now, do you get the idea? 52 plus 18, meaning Cyrus allowed them to build it 52 years after the destruction, which was actually 70 years after the conquest. See, 70 keeps in that way. But it was stopped for 18 years. Now, what happened during those last 18 years? Cyrus eventually died. Cyrus is replaced by another man who is said to be Cyrus's son-in-law. That other man, actually might be Cyrus's son, I'm sorry. And that man is none other than the king that we know as Ahasuerus of the Purim story. So you got this. Ahasuerus reigned in the last 18 years when the Beis HaMikdash was not being built. And then we have the whole story of Purim. And why is Mordechai back in Persia? Or not back in Persia. How did Mordechai get to Persia? Now remember, Mordechai was exiled 11 years before the destruction of the temple to Babylonia. Mordechai is recorded as one of the few Jews who returned when Cyrus gave them permission. Now he's already must be old because it's been more than 52 years since the destruction of the temple. And he was exiled 11 years before that, so that's 63. And he was already a person of eminence 63 years before. Right, so we don't know exactly how old was he. Was he 20? Was he 30? Was he 40? But after Cyrus stopped the construction of the temple, Mordechai moved to Shushan, which was the Persian capital, because he thought he could intercede and help the Jewish people by being near the seat of government. That's how Mordechai goes from Yerushalayim to Babylonia, back to Yerushalayim, and then to Shushan. Now, where he died, he probably died in Shushan. He probably did not come back, but some actually say he did come back after the 18 years, and I'll discuss where you get those 18 years. Yeah.
You were saying last time that it was in the 70th year that the Persians took over the Babylonian Empire?
It was 70 years from the conquest. Now remember, the conquest was that's how it is. The conquest was 18 years earlier than the destruction of the temple. Okay? In other words, Persia took over 70 years from the Babylonian conquest. But that's only 52 years from the destruction of the temple. Darius just died after a few months, so Cyrus actually became king that same year.
Okay.
Now, what happened was, you know the Purim story. I'm not going to go over the Purim story, but as you know, during that brief period, the Jewish people were facing mass extinction. HaKadosh Baruch Hu brought the great, great miracle, as it were. Ahasuerus died shortly thereafter. Who became king of Persia and king of Eretz Yisrael, by definition, after Ahasuerus died? According to Chazal, and this is very strange, Ahasuerus actually had a son from Queen Esther. That son is halachically Jewish, because his mother was Jewish. But since he was the son of Ahasuerus, he became the king of Persia. And his name is Dariush. He is Dariush the Second, Darius the Second. Darius the Second rescinded the order of cessation of Koresh that was reaffirmed by Ahasuerus. He allowed the Jews to continue building the temple. So it's an interesting irony of history that the actual Persian king who allowed the rebuilding of the Second Temple was a Jewish. Now, this is shrouded in a lot of mystery. Did Darius regard himself as Jewish? Was he from? Did he put on tefillin? You know, we don't know, because again, the whole thing is a tragedy in many ways. Although, obviously, Esther was in the right place, but on a personal level, she was essentially forcibly, you know, raped by this non-Jew, and she has a child from this non-Jew. This was not an easy situation for her. You know, I know they like to portray in the Talmud Torahs in the States that, you know, Esther was like a Miss Universe contest. You know, she was parading in a beauty pageant and she won the beauty pageant. For Esther to be chosen queen under those circumstances was not a win. It was a deep, deep tragedy. But she saw in retrospect that this was the sacrifice that was necessary to save the Jewish people. And in strange ways that we don't understand, it was Darius II. It was a Jewish king who allowed the Second Temple to rebuild. So the Second Temple was completed 70 years from the destruction of the First Temple. Okay? They began 52 years after the destruction of the First Temple. There was an 18-year cessation for the duration of the reigns of Cyrus and Darius II. And then Darius II allowed it to be rebuilt. Now still, let me point out, more Jews came, but still, most of the Jewish world were living outside of the land of Israel. Now, let me just give you a few names of leaders that you need to know. The leader, the political leader of the Jewish people at the time of the dedication of the Second Temple, I mean the building, the completion of the Second Temple, I don't mean the first one, was a man whose name was Zerubbabel. That's why in the song, you know the song, Mo'oz, sorry, I know that you're getting singing lessons here from Rabbi Yaffe, you're learning all the Hanukkah songs, so I assume that you've gone over Mo'oz Tzur. So I hope that you learned that Mo'oz Tzur is an alphabetical song that spells Mordechai. Mordechai is just the name of the author. But each stanza refers to a different exile. The first stanza describes generally how Hashem saves us and protects us. The second stanza is about Egypt. The third stanza, which is really pre-exile. The third stanza is Babylonia. The fourth stanza is Purim and Haman, which is Persia. The fifth stanza, which is the only one about Hanukkah, is about the Greek Gullus, which we haven't gotten to. The sixth one is about the Edomite exile. And the last stanza is about how Hashem will bring the redemption eventually. Now, in the Babylonian stanza, there is a line, because it rhymes, Kates Bavel, Zerubbabel. The end of Babylon is Zerubbabel. And for some reason, this strikes a lot of children as funny. I don't know exactly why. Kates Bavel, Zerubbabel, whatever, because Zerubbabel sounds like a nonsense syllable. But not at all. Zerubbabel was the name of a very great person, who in fact will be the ancestor of Mashiach. He was Jehoiachin's son, the last survivor of the Davidic line. And in fact, Zerubbabel literally means conceived in Babylon. There's a whole story. King Jehoiachin was languishing in prison. and he was allowed a conjugal visit with his wife. And she was lowered. Again, it was very odd. He was in a pit, not even a cell, a pit. And if they were to have any conjugal visitation, they would literally be standing up. That's how confined it was. And when he's entitled to the conjugal visit, she says that she sees a drop of blood that would render her a nida. So Yehoyachin says, can't do it. And in the merit of that great Mesirat Nefesh, which would have been very, very difficult, Hashem gave another opportunity. And Hashem wanted to destroy Yehoyachin. He was a Rasha. He was not righteous. Hashem said he's not worthy. But in the merit of that one mitzvah, he said he would give him a child, and that child would be the ancestor of Mashiach. And that was Zerubbabel. So Zerubbabel is the political leader, not the king, because remember, they're under Persian rule, but he is the Jewish leader. What Gedaliah was is Zerubbabel. The spiritual leaders are Ezra and Nehemiah, who came from Persia. Now, let me point out, Ezra and Nehemiah came after the Second Temple was dedicated. Zerubbabel was at the dedication of the Second Temple. Ezra and Nehemiah were not. They came afterwards. And Ezra in particular is considered to be as great as Moshe Rabbeinu. And Ezra organized the greatest sages into a group that we call the Anshei Knesset Hagdola, the men of the Great Assembly, 120 elders who made many takanos and gezeros, and they actually wrote the Siddur, they wrote the prayers, they wrote the Shemona Esrei, they wrote many of the tefillos, the blessings before and after the Shema. Right? They wrote it. The text of Kiddush, the text of Havdalah, the text of Birkas HaMazon. Again, Birkas HaMazon is deraisa, but the Torah doesn't tell you what you say. They actually wrote all of these sacred liturgies and the like. Mordechai may have still been alive, and Mordechai could have been a member of the Anshei Knesset Gedolah as well, although he was very, very old at this stage. Right? So we have Zerubbabel, we have Ezra and Nehemiah, and the Kohen Gadol is Yehoshua, the Kohen Gadol. He was the first Kohen Gadol of the second Beis HaMikdash. Okay. Other people to know? Prophecy is about to die out. Prophecy existed throughout the First Temple period and before the First Temple period. It existed during the 70 years of Babylonian exile, and it exists at the very beginning of the Second Temple. But then it dies out. It's taken away from us. The last three prophets are Haggai, Zechariah, Malachi. When they died, prophecy died with them. Okay, there is no Nevuah in the Bayit Sheni except for the very beginning of the dedication. In fact, it is Haggai that gave a lot of mussar about building the temple. Now that you have a chance, because apparently people were taking their time, and he gives them a lot of mussar about, Hashem gives you this temple, you have to build it. Right? This is the book of Haggai. Haggai, Zechariah, Malachi. Some say Malachi is another name for Ezra, so some of the names are interchangeable as well. In the Tanakh, they're represented as distinct people, but there are midrashim that make them the same. Yeah.
What exactly causes the prophecy to end?
Okay, so here I'm going to tell you a very, very interesting teaching. The Gemara in Yuma recounts a very amazing thing. When Ezra established the Anshei Knesset HaGdola, and they're trying to rebuild spiritual life. For example, in the book of Ezra, you see there was a big, big problem with intermarriage. Many Jewish men had married non-Jewish women, etc., and Ezra had to stop that. And in other words, Am Yisrael as a whole was not so religious. I mean, he needed to be mechazek, Torah, and Yiddishkeit. That's why he's compared to Moshe Rabbeinu, because he literally took people who had become like Goyim, and he made them Ovdei Hashem again. That's why, just like Moshe took the slaves out of Mitzrayim, and he made them worthy to receive the Torah. So Ezra is treated as the second Moshe Rabbeinu in many ways. So one of the things Ezra said was the following. The Beis HaMikdash was destroyed And the worst sin that people were doing was Avodah Zarah. So let's ask Hashem to take away the Yetzer Hara for idolatry. Because apparently, this was such a powerful Yetzer Hara that people couldn't control themselves. If we don't feel it, it's because of what happened. Now, to ask Hashem to take away a Yetzer Hara is an extraordinary action. Because the one thing God does not want to interfere with is, God never wants to interfere with free will. If you take away the urge, you're taking away the opportunity for free will. But this was such an extreme power that the 120 elders and the other people, they fasted for 3 days so Hashem should take away the Yetzer Hara for idolatry. And he says, after they fasted, now this imagery will almost be impossible to understand, so we explain it. But it says, a fiery lion, a lion of fire, left the Kodesh HaKadoshim, the Holy of Holies, and went into the Judean desert. And that was the Yetzer Hara of idolatry. And from that time onwards, we don't have this overwhelming desire to worship these idols. Of course, the Vilna Gaon says that everything is replaced. So if you want to know what the Yetzer Hara for idolatry felt like, look at the Yetzer Hara for money, which becomes the new idolatry, money and power. But so you might ask, what did we gain by this? But you'll see. Okay. Now then there's an act too. I think Ezra was kind of surprised that Hashem listened to him. So he said, we got rid of one Yetzer Hara. Let's work on another Yetzer Hara. Let's get rid of the Yetzer Hara of Giloy Arayos, sexual impropriety. Take away the urges. And that was answered as well. But what happened was, nobody got married. Nobody had children. So you really can't separate the good one and the bad one there. Meaning we need those urges in the world because that creates the possibilities of life. So he prayed that we get that one back. And unfortunately, now it can be used in bad ways as well. But we have to get it back. Now, this is really a long answer to your question. This will answer your question. Now here's the problem. First of all, it's very strange. Avodah Zarah is the biggest sin in the Torah. Why would it be visualized as a lion of fire coming out of the Kodesh HaKadoshim, which is the holiest part of the Mikdash? The answer is, if you look in the Rambam, when the Rambam explains the historical origin of idolatry, how did idolatry start? I mean, Adam was created by God and this was handed down to his children. How does idolatry start? Good, once it starts, so you know people get fooled by it, but like, who's the first guy who worships idols? So the Rambam says idolatry actually started. It didn't end up that way, but it started out of great reverence for God. The idea was that people had such reverence for God that they felt it was disrespectful for them to go to Hashem directly. You know, if your garbage was not picked up, all right, today people don't have respect for politicians, but in theory, if your garbage wasn't picked up, you know, you're not going to go to Obama, let's say the United States, you're going to go to the president and make a complaint. You know, you don't bother the president with minor things. You go to subordinate people. Well, they felt that Hashem is so mighty, Hashem is so great, Hashem is so powerful. This is a mistake, this is not right, but this is their thinking. That, who am I? How dare I go to the creator of the universe and talk about my insignificant life and my insignificant needs? I will go to the subordinate powers that God created, the sun and the moon, and you know, talk to them. But really, I'm acknowledging that God is supreme. So this is a big mistake, because Hashem says, I want to hear your prayers. But the point the Rambam is making is an interesting point. Idolatry came out of a misplaced reverence for the Almighty. And I think that this is marumas in the idea that when God took away the Yetzer Hara Avodah Zarah, he took away something holy from us. Meaning like this. How many of us think, listen, maybe we're tired, maybe we don't want to get up for davening, but how many of us are afraid to daven? How many of us feel like we're shaking and trembling? How dare I go to God? Who am I to go to God? Can't do it. I'm not good enough. I'm not worthy enough. We don't have that feeling. If anything, we have a sense, which is good, of familiarity with God. Yeah, me and God, we're buddies. Sure, I can talk to you whenever I want. Meaning like this. Taking away the Yetzer Hara of Avodah Zarah is like a spiritual lobotomy. Now, Baruch Hashem, they don't do lobotomy so much today. But when they used to do it fairly often, a person has seizures, a person has uncontrollable rages. So they would cut away part of the brain which was causing that. Now, that's good and that's bad. It's good if it worked because you took away the source of the seizures. But it's bad because when you take something away, there's something good in it that you took away as well. Like the old brain surgeon joke, you know, there goes the piano lessons, whatever it is, the knife slips a little bit. You know, so the thing is this. Here's what I want to suggest to you. Hashem listened to the prayers of the Antichrist of the Gola to take away the Yetzer of idolatry because it was too dangerous. But the way it was taken away is by giving us less of a reverence for God. So I have less of a Yetzer for idolatry because I'm less scared of going to God. In other words, the way the sickness was healed was taking away our sensitivity to spirituality. So, here's what it is. Prophecy is that exquisite connection to Hashem that generates within your heart that reverence and that awe. But if that got misdirected into idolatry, Hashem had to take away that reverence and awe. If he took away that reverence and awe, we lost prophecy. So we lost prophecy when we lost the Yetzer Hara of idolatry.
And we see from like characters like Cain and Esau that the Yetzer Hara for power and money already existed in the world.
Yeah.
So what do you mean by why that one? Why do they say that was replaced?
Well, I don't mean to say it was invented. I'm sure, obviously, it did exist beforehand. But we mean to say that it grew in intensity because the idea is, money becomes our new idol. Because what is idol? Avodah Zarah is anything that you put as the center of the existence of your life. So if you're living for careerism, you're living for money, you're living for power, you're living for pleasure, that becomes your God in a small g. So it is a form of idolatry. Maybe it's self-idolatry. It's either idolization of yourself or idolization of these ideals and the like.
And that Yetzer Hara was in the non-Jews as well?
Yeah, that's for sure. That's for sure. Okay, that's why I would say the following. You know, I'll give you a little observation. You can take it or leave it. You know, unfortunately, many, many Jews are attracted to Buddhism, Eastern religions. In fact, 9 out of 10 English-speaking converts to Eastern religions are Jewish. 9 out of 10. Jews especially love Eastern religions. Now, why do they love Eastern religions? They love Eastern religions because they say they're spiritual. They say Judaism is not spiritual, they'll say. They grew up and the Judaism they saw, usually not Orthodox Judaism, but they saw Judaism and they saw it was fixated. I mean, not Judaism, but Jews. Again, these are painful stereotypes, you know. Fixated on money, fixated on connections, on status. Even the derogative, insulting, really not true term, Jap, you know, Jewish American princess. I shouldn't be slandering my people. Okay, but be it as it may, these are stereotypes that exist in the world. And so, the spiritual Jewish adolescent will say, I want to be connected to God. I want to be connected to something beyond money. So I'm going to go to Buddhism to find it. Of course, a lot of Eastern religions are idolatry. So, on one hand, this is very, very sad news. But I think it's also good news, because what it indicates is that these are people who potentially can become the best Jews because their desires are spiritual. In effect, you can almost say the angel missed them, meaning they're left with the Yetzer Hara for idolatry coming from a desire for spirituality. In other words, you know, you could argue, I mean, you know, you could argue that a Jew who rebels against the materialism and decadence of the world is acting out of a very spiritual motive, even though it is displaced and perverted and moving in the totally wrong direction. But because of that feeling, there is even a greater potential to bring them back to Torah, as opposed to a person who is material and fixated on the superficial. Even if they're keeping the commandments, it's harder for them to have a connection with Hashem because they're not really focused on spirituality as something that's fundamentally important to them. Again, it's a difficult issue. But the idea I want to bring out is a bit of a deep idea. That is, the koach of nevuah is actually correlated with the yetzer hara of avodah zarah. They left at the same time. Right? Because the yetzer hara of avodah zarah comes from an acute sensitivity to spirituality. And that is what causes prophecy to exist. Okay. Now, here is what you need to know. The biblical history ends here. The Tanakh ends with the dedication of the second Beis HaMikdash. In fact, that's why the Tanakh ends when prophecy ends. After prophecy, we no longer have the sacred books. Okay? So, how many Babylonian kings ruled over the Jews? Three. Okay? Three kings. Nebuchadnezzar, his son Evil-Merodach, and Belshazzar, the grandson, who is Vashti's father. How many Persian kings? Four. Darius I, who only ruled for a few months. Cyrus, that's Koresh. Ahasuerus of Purim. And Daryavish Hasheni, who is the last Persian king in Tanakh. And that whole period is only lasts around 50 years, the Persian period. Okay. What happens afterwards? What happened next? So Darius himself ruled, Darius II, Esther's son, ruled for around 30 years into the Second Temple. But in the meantime, to the west, there was a great, great world power that was developing, under the leadership of the man that is known as Alexander the Great. Alexander the Great is from Macedonia, but just to show you, his father Philip was king of Macedonia, and just to show you, when you have money you can buy anything, Philip wanted his son to have a good private education, so he hired Aristotle to be his tutor. Aristotle, the greatest philosopher of the ancient world, and the Rambam considered Aristotle to be on the Madrega of Moshe if he would have believed in Hashem. The Rambam considered Aristotle to be the greatest of the great in terms of a non-Jewish mind, except for the very regrettable fact that he did not believe in God properly. So Aristotle actually was Alexander the Great's private tutor. Alexander became a world conqueror, as you know, including Africa, even as far as India. And Alexander conquered the greatest empire of the time, which was the Persian Empire. So Alexander did not wage war against Israel, you have to understand. Alexander conquered the Persian Empire, and he automatically became king of Eretz Israel. And this introduces the period known as the Greek exile. So it's not a new exile. Most of the Jews anyway are living in Chutz Laaretz. And the Jews have a Beis HaMikdash, those who are living in Eretz Yisrael, but we are now under Greek domination. Now, Alexander was not a native Greek, but his culture, from Aristotle, was Greek. And Alexander, by and large, was a benign conqueror. Alexander was not an Antiochus. Alexander was not someone that said, you know, you got to worship idols. But Alexander was what we would call, you have to understand his philosophy, he was a cultural assimilationist, meaning to say that he very much was committed to the Greek ideas of philosophy, of science, of aesthetics, of athleticism, glorifying the body as well, the Olympics and the like. And he believed that in order to foster an empire, because his empire had all these different cultures, the Jews were not his major problem. I mean, we like, you know, I guess this is the way Jews think. You know, we always like to assume that Alexander was spending all of his days and nights thinking about the Jewish people. No, I mean, he had this huge empire, and the Jews were an element in the empire, an important element, and he just wanted everybody to be the same. He says, but he did not try to accomplish this by coercion. He tried to accomplish it by carrots more than sticks. In other words, he built gymnasiums, he built stadiums, he built coliseums, although that's more of a Roman thing, but he built all these things with boxing matches and culture and statues. And what happened was, over time, he was quite successful. He was successful without any types of wars, with no gezeirot, no anti-Semitic laws or anything like that. Many, many Jews, as well as people in the rest of the empire, they simply assimilated into the tenets and belief systems of what was called Hellenism. Hellas was the Greek name for Greece, so Hellenism is just the Greek philosophy of life, including the glorification of the body, beauty, science, philosophy. It was intellectual and physical. There's a lot going for it. It is really the basis of Western civilization, but it excluded God from the picture. It excluded Hashem, because they didn't believe in God. They believed in multiplicity of gods, and the gods were not sources of morality either. They were as decrepit as the people that portrayed them. So you have to understand that this so-called Hellenistic period, way before Antiochus, is not here yet. It just resulted in widespread assimilation. Now, assimilation, just like today, takes different forms. At its extreme, there were Jews who intermarried with non-Jews and stopped keeping Shabbos and stopped keeping kosher. And there were many. But there were also Jews who were still keeping the mitzvot, but their cultural understandings were more influenced by Hellenism than Torah. Okay, that's different, meaning they were. Again, this has so many analogies to modern life. There are Jews who have left the Torah, and there are Jews that keep the Torah externally, but their real philosophy of life is not not Judaism. It's whatever it is. They keep the Torah, that's fine, which is good also. Again, better to keep than not to keep. So when we talk about assimilation and Hellenization, you have to understand that there's a very, very big spectrum, ranging from people who became totally not connected to Hashem to people who kept the externals, but they were influenced by Hellenistic philosophy. This was Alexander the Great. Yeah.
So now we've had three different exiles.
Yep.
And two of them have been where just another nation takes over another
nation. That's right.
So I'm a little confused, because my understanding of exile would be you're in a place, you're sent out, you come back, you establish yourself, and someone else comes in and sends you out.
Right. So that's correct. So this is exactly the point that I want to bring out. That is not a correct... You're correct. That is what we normally would say galus means. But that's not what it means here. Here, it simply means that your state of estrangement and alienation is simply taken over by different governments, and they represent different spiritual ideas, though. That's the idea. And remember as well, the other thing to remember too, that the galus of Persia and Greece, we at least some Jews, are living in Eretz Israel and have a Beis HaMikdash, and it's still called the galus. You can be in galus. So when people say, tell you today, oh, how can you talk about galus? We have the state of Israel. Well, they were living in Eretz Israel, and they had a Beis HaMikdash there too, but they're in galus. because they are still estranged and separated from God. Now, you know about Alexander the Great, that Alexander the Great died as a very young man. Alexander the Great died at the age of 32. He died, he died in Africa. He contracted some type of plague, malaria. And legend has it, we don't know if it's true, that he died of a broken heart because he cried and he said he had no more worlds to conquer. He conquered the whole known world. He didn't know of America at the time. The Gemara itself in Maseches Tamid gives us stories of his encountering tribes of Amazon women in Africa. And when he asked them to give him something to eat, they brought him loaves of bread of gold. And he said, I can't eat gold. So they told him, well, you didn't come to Africa to get bread, did you? You can get bread in your own country. Okay. But be it as it may, one final story about Alexander the Great. Similar to what happened in the days of Ezra, there were non-Jews who accused the Jewish people of trying to rebel against Alexander. So he did send an army to Jerusalem to crush what he thought was a revolt. And the Kohen Gadol at the time was a name that you surely know. This was Shimon HaTzadik, who has the street named after him, and his kever is across the street, but don't go there now, these days. And Shimon HaTzadik went to intercede on behalf of the Jewish people. And Alexander got off his horse. Actually, the horse is also a famous horse in Greek mythology. And he went on his knees. And he said to Shimon HaTzadik, you are the man that comes to me in my dreams every night, telling me not to destroy Yerushalayim. And I ignored the dream. I thought it was just a dream. But I see that Hashem sent the dream to me. And he called off his attack. And it is the Gemara in Yuma records that year, every Jewish boy that was born was given the name Alexander to commemorate this great simcha. And that is how Alexander, which is a Greek name, it's not a Jewish name, but it is now a name that a person could be called to the Torah with, because it got introduced into Klal Yisrael as a result of that. Okay, that's Alexander. Okay, so we'll talk next time about how we continue that. That introduces the third gullus, the gullus of Yavah.